Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Thursday. It's summertime. So relaxing. Perfect day for a little bit of open forum. People can call and ask any question they want. And they can be Catholic. They can be not Catholic. They can be anybody. Just open forum. A nice summer afternoon show. What we need is Joe Heschmeyer and Jimmy Akin for that. And that's who we've got. Second hour, Jimmy will be here. First hour, Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of Pope Peter and several other books. You are welcome to ask him anything you want. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. However, I believe there is some kind of tomfoolery going on with the internet in Kansas City. So we've got Joe on the phone. You there with us, Joe? Is he there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are, Joe. Hi.
Hey, sorry about that. Yeah. We just got Google Fiber, which is like way faster, but for some reason, it's completely down right now, which is way slower.
Well, we don't want to say anything bad about Google because then your life just gets harder. They hear you.
At this point, they already know.
Okay, so what you're saying is Google Fiber is terrible. All right, I got the message, Joe. You ready to take any question at all from the internet?
I'm ready to give it a shot.
Or from it's not just the internet; it's from anywhere that people could be listening on the radio, could be watching on Facebook. I guess that's internet. 888-318-7884, the number to call. 888-31-TRUTH. And Joe, I was mentioning your books. Will you just say something just real quick? A quick word about the St. Joseph book, because I think some people are missing out on the year of St. Joseph. It's a beautiful thing that Pope Francis did. I'm very grateful, and I know many people are grateful to him. So tell them about your St. Joseph book, and then we'll go to some calls.
Yeah, so I've got a book called A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And kind of the starting point from it is if I'm being totally honest, I'm not a huge fan of a lot of books about the saints because I find that they're a little too speculative, and they're sometimes a little too schmaltzy, maybe like an uncharted for it. But like something in that direction is where I often find it ending up for me, where it's like, okay, like maybe all of that's true, but where's the support? Where's the evidence? And so I tried to write a different kind of, like I wanted to write a book for people who don't like saints about a saint. And this was the result.
Very nice. That is great. And so he's a guardian for our times. Why?
Yeah, so that's the first kind of title, or one of the first titles that he gets, is this notion of, like, protector of the universal church. He's the patron of the universal church. And so it's really this question of, like, why does he have that role? And that's a lot of what it's asking. Also, like, tied in with that is this idea of Joseph as Redemptoris Custos, like the guardian of the Redeemer, that he is in charge of protecting Jesus from death, when Jesus is the one who ultimately protects all of us from eternal death. Like Joseph has this really fascinating role in like the flight into Egypt, where the God of the universe, the God who's going to save us from death, allows himself to be put in harm's way and to be saved in a certain way physically, right?
Right.
By Joseph, by this flight into Egypt, that he is the guy who can say with the appropriate qualifications, he saved the Savior. From being slaughtered as an infant. That's a really fascinating thing that we don't explore that much. It's often just like, oh, yeah, and then there was a flight into Egypt, and they came back, and it's like, right, let's unpack that. Like, what's actually going on here?
Right.
Let's think about this a little bit theologically. And it's really rich. It's really a good matter for meditation. So I try to set the book up where there's a theological reflection. There's some questions, especially for, small groups or just for individual kind of pondering. And then there's a prayer, and not a prayer of my own composing, but a prayer that some great saint or someone in the church has written to Saint Joseph. It kind of lets us explore it from both the theological and the spiritual dimension.
Beautiful. A man named Joseph, guardian for our times. And Joe Heschmeyer is its author, and he doesn't like saints. You're welcome to call 888-31. No, that probably came out wrong. I probably summed that up a little bit too tersely.
Not quite what I said. Not quite what I said.
888-318-7884. The number one line open now, so you can still get in to get your question on with Joe. 888 318-7884. Open forum means open to anyone, and we certainly welcome a call. If you're not a Christian person and you're baffled by something that we Christians believe, that we claim, that we do, you're very, very welcome here. But maybe you're a brother or sister Christian who is not a Catholic, and yeah, you have those feelings about Catholics, then you're welcome to call as well. And of course, if you're Catholic and you just want to know something more about your faith, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I'm going to go to line one, just letting you know, those on the phone in there, to Connor in Louisiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, also referred to often as the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Connor, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi, guys. So I was reading a book the other day about, I forgot who it was, but it's about science and science fiction. And the author brought up quantum entanglement for communications. And if we ever figured it out, essentially it would upset causality, because if I sent a message to someone, they would get it before I sent it to them. And so I was just wondering, could that in some way be used to prove free will in regards to the relation of our soul to our body?
Wow. Oh,
really fascinating. Really, I did not know where the start of the question was going to go in terms of the end of the question. I would say this. I think that we need to distinguish two lines of order. And the first is temporal order. This is just your normal before or after. This thing happened and that thing happened. But then the other is the line of causality, which is this is the cause and this is the effect. And we usually put those two things together. And sometimes we put them together fallaciously. You know, there's the famous error post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means after this, therefore, because of this, that, you know, well, right now, it's raining, and my internet went out. And so I immediately am like, well, my internet must be out because it's raining. I have no idea if that's true. That's just, you know, me looking at, like, this thing happened temporally, and then this other thing happened, and therefore they must be connected. We want to be careful to distinguish those things, right? For instance, if you have a box on top of another box, there's a causal relationship to them. That second box is causally dependent on the first one for its location. If the first box was gone, the second box would fall down, right? Like, just in terms of gravity, but they're both there simultaneously. Now, this, some people are like, what in the world are they talking about? This is so nerdy. But it's actually a really important point to distinguish these two for a lot of reasons. For instance, when we talk about the Son being eternally begotten of the Father, what we're saying is that there is a causal relationship between Father and Son, but there's not a temporal relationship in the sense that there ever was a time when the Son was not.
Oh.
So we have to distinguish between the causal and the temporal. And the cool thing about theories like quantum entanglement is that they point out that these two things that we associate might not be as closely tied together as we think they are. Now, I don't want to make any like speculations about quantum entanglement or anything, because that's well above my pay grade. But I will say, like, I think that's a really fruitful kind of dimension to explore with it. I would be hesitant. I mean, I'd love to hear your theory about free will, but I'd be hesitant to make any kind of claims one way or the other on a quantum basis, because I think it's frankly too weak of a foundation to build an argument one way or the other on.
All right. That's fascinating stuff, though. Thank you both for that. Connor, I appreciate the call and the question. But I got to take a quick break, and we got lots of more folks on the line, so we're going to do more open forum with Joe Heschmeyer right after this. Before I send you off to the break, it's treat yourself time at shop.catholic.com. 25% off everything. And you know what? There's always a but. 25% off everything except. 25% off everything but. Nope, not now. 25% off everything. Is it 25% off on Joe Heschmeyer's book, Pope Peter? Oh, yes, it is. Is it 25% off on, name another book, Joe. What other book might we mention?
Trent Horn's book on why we're Catholic.
Okay. I don't even know why I have you on, Joe. That's the best you could come up with, Trent Horn's book on why we're Catholic?
Did you write a book? I can't remember.
25% off everything right now at shop.catholic.com.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN podcasts are the perfect companion for busy Catholics everywhere. Your favorite EWTN programs are waiting for you to listen to on your time. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off, anytime, anywhere. Just subscribe by using your mobile device's free podcast app. Find old favorites or discover something new. EWTN Podcasts, they're waiting for you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, something we're very, very proud of. Joe's been doing this for a long time and has chosen to join the Catholic Answers family this year, and that makes us very, very happy. And as part of joining the Catholic Answers family, he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to upgrade my internet so that when I'm doing the radio show, there'll be no interruptions. And he did it, and he paid the extra money. And then his internet went out. So that's just the way it goes, I guess. 888-318-7884, the number. We have Joe on the phone line. And we also have Stan in St. Genevieve, Missouri, listening on EWTN. Stan, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi, Joe. Joe, I've got a question about the Stations of the Cross. In the sixth Station of the Cross, it talks about Veronica. And I've not been able to find that in the Gospels. Can you help me with where that may have come from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The short answer is there's no direct reference to that in the Gospels. The slightly longer answer is this is a tradition in both the East and the West, but we have different names for the woman in question. The East refers to her as Bernice. The West refers to her as Veronica. But Veronica may have originally been a title rather than a name. Vero is true, icon is image, and she's the one who presses the cloth on Jesus' face and gets a true image. So it's possible that her name originally is Bernice, but she just becomes known as Veronica because she has the Vero icon, the true icon. And so she's become known as Veronica. She's, I believe, the first person to ever have that name or to be, you know, given that name. There is some extra scriptural support for the fact that the face cloth that was pressed to Jesus' face really did exist. Like, this doesn't just appear to be like a legend. We have some pretty early attestation that there really is like an imprint of Jesus' face on a cloth. And so the story has some evidence supporting it, but then it's also supported by a small t and large t tradition, I would say, as well as by some mystical kind of vision. So the stations, in part, are based on testimonies of the events of the life of Christ in terms of, like, kind of mystical apparitions. They're not, like, you don't have to believe everything happened exactly in the order that the stations depict it in order to be a good Catholic, would be the kind of the last thing I'd say on that.
Does that make sense, Stan?
Yes. So to add to this, I have a daughter that is in the convent, and she gave my wife and I what is called the Holy Face of Jesus. This is was done in the 1850s by Pope Leo. Every year, he brought the original cloth out. And there was people that made renditions of them, and they were laid on the Holy Face. They were laid on the Veronica's veil as a relic. And I've got one of those, and it actually has a letter of authenticity from the Vatican with it that was on the back underneath the glass. So it's a very, very close thing for me and my wife, having something like that is associated with the Vale of Ronica. So I'm just kind of was always asking, kind of never knew where it was actually at in the scripture.
Yeah. So actually, if you go to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, you'll see around like the main altar that there are St. Longinus, the Roman soldier who converts after piercing the side of Christ, and I believe Ronica and two others are kind of the four saints that are sort of the pillars in that main area. And at least what I've been told from people who do the tours in St. Peter's, that relics related to all four of them are actually preserved in St. Peter's in those respective spots. Now, a lot of the relics we have from this era, Saint Helen, the mother of the Emperor Constantine, went to the Holy Land and gathered as many, you know, relics and the like that she could, and she had, you know, the imperial budget to do it. So a lot of those things really do have an ancient provenance, and it's hard to document them before the 4th century, but they do seem to be real. Like Christians, certainly from an early day, kept relics, kept, you know, things associated with the saints. We get hints of this even in Acts, where people are bringing handkerchiefs that have been touched to Paul to the sick to heal them. You know, like people had this very kind of incarnational sense that anything bodily associated with the saints, including their bones, their bodies, but also just things that had touched them, should be preserved. And so for sure, if these early accounts of Veronica touching the face of Jesus and having this imprint seemingly miraculously on the veil, now that would be something that people, they're going to keep. They're going to take that seriously. So it kind of makes sense. It checks out. I don't think we can prove it beyond a skeptic's, you know, skepticism, but I think it's not an irrational thing to believe in either.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, Stan. Lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep moving. It's open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and we go now to Topeka, Kansas. Thomas in Topeka, Kansas, watching on YouTube. You are up next. Go ahead with your question, Thomas.
Hey, Joe. I got to know you a little bit when you were with School of Faith. Came, did quite a few talks at my church. But anyways, I have a friend who is Catholic, who has recently been toying with the idea of switching over to become an Eastern Orthodox. I know you wrote a book about, what was it? It was Pope Peter. I know you wrote a book about that. I don't know if it mentions anything in it, but I guess I need a little bit of ammunition to dissuade this, I guess.
Joe?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little tricky without knowing the exact reasons why he wants to switch. I think the most effective kind of apologetic in those contexts is going to be personal, based on like the reasons that a person is considering leaving the church. You know, if it's something about being scandalized about, you know, some scandal in the church, or if it's something where it's a theological question, like, well, where do we see the primacy of the Pope in the first millennium, or any of those things. So I can give you kind of a brief, hopefully one-size-fits-all answer, but I'll say that with the caveats that, like, it might be more effective to just really dig into what's drawing him, to know what kind of things might be helpful for him to know. But I can say that at least on the basic level, a few things. One, I do explain in Pope Peter that the papal structure is something given to us by Christ, that he doesn't just create 12 co-equal apostles. He puts one of them in this position of authority, even relative to the other ones. If that's true, and if that's a structure that he intends in its main form to endure, that's a strong argument for the papacy, that he doesn't set up a congregational structure. He doesn't set up a merely episcopal structure where every bishop or every apostle has an equal authority, that he really does continually draw out certain members of the 12, the pillars, Peter, James, John, sometimes Andrew, and then within that draws out one of them, Peter. That, like, this is showing Jesus's preference for the church. This is showing his design for the church. And you'll find early testimony in both the East and the West that this is carried on in a unique way in the Bishop of Rome, that all of the churches associated with Peter, meaning Antioch, Rome, and Alexandria, which was founded by Peter's disciple Mark, have this connection as apostolic sees, plural. But there's only one apostolic see in the singular, meaning like anytime you hear an early church father talking about the apostolic see, whether they're in the East or the West, they always mean Rome. That's pointing to its unique status, carrying on this promise, really, made to Peter, and carrying on. So even though there's some sense in which every bishop carries on some of that apostolic authority, there's a unique sense in which the Bishop of Rome does. We also get this attested in both the East and West from the earliest days. So, for instance, St. Ignatius of Antioch, when he's writing to the Romans, describes him as presiding over the church in love, that there's already this sense, and he's writing maybe 107 to 110, somewhere in there, there's already this sense that they have some kind of authority. We have even before that, I do mention this in the book, Pope Clement, around 96, is writing to the Corinthian church, and he's settling an internal dispute in their church. And this is really remarkable, because here's this church in the East that's not terribly far from where the Apostle John is, and here they are writing to the Bishop of Rome, asking him to settle a controversy in their church. And I find that personally to be pretty indicative of him having this kind of authority to settle these questions. So we can see plenty of things that kind of fit in that mold. Now, we want to be clear that the Bishop of Rome was never a dictator, never, you know, the theological know-it-all who just personally answered every question. But there is a clear sense in which Rome served as a court of last resort. When you find the bishops in the East, even the patriarchs in the East, when they disagree with each other, they'll write to the Bishop of Rome, and whoever he sides with, that side will be like, well, you have to listen because it's, you know, it's the Bishop of Rome, it's the Pope. One of the most famous instances of this is in what's called the Tome of Leo, where the Eastern bishops had tried to hold a council. The Pope rejected it, and so neither the East nor the West today considers it valid. It's described as a robber council. And then Pope Leo sets the matter straight on the theological issue in question, and his writing, known as the Tome of Leo, was received by the new church council, which was rejected by, or, excuse me, was accepted by both the East and the West. The fathers of that council received it and said, Peter has spoken through Leo. Now, there are a lot of other instances of this, but it shows we can see that this is not some late innovation. This is something we see very much in the early church. There are some practical limitations to how much the Pope can get involved in the day-to-day affairs of another church. Like, you know, especially in the early centuries when Christianity is persecuted, communication lines are not always good. But there's still this sense there's some sort of leadership and authority the Pope has. And we see some pretty clear witnesses to this.
I hope that that's helpful to you, Thomas. If you'd like, we can send you a copy of Pope Peter, and maybe just reading it yourself will give you a kind of a basis on which to have these conversations with your friend. Thank you again for the call. It's Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Raymond in Iowa, watching on YouTube. Raymond, thank you very much for your call. Hang on, Raymond. I got to get to the right line here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay, I've been listening to your show for a couple of months now, and I've been a Protestant for over 40 years, born again Protestant, and I was taught all the wrong things about Catholicism from the very beginning, and now I'm finally stumbled upon your show, and I'm seeing it, and I think I'm 90% there.
Oh,
and praise God. I would probably go to confession right now if I knew where to go. But what I think I need to do is, since it would be my first confession, I think I need to further unburden my soul and not pick his standard 15 minutes. I would like to maybe find a Catholic priest who is also a counselor who I could spend an hour or two with and kind of go over, not just confess my sins, but
right.
You know, give me some guidance on how to let go of some of that old past and realize what I did. I mean, I know there's so many things I did wrong, but I know I need confession and reconciliation and penance and all that. If I could get past that, I could take the Eucharist, and I think it'd be the most blessed thing ever happened to me.
That's incredible. Can I give you my email address, and I will try to put you in connection to a priest in your area?
Okay.
So my email is joh@catholic.com.
Joe?
If you email me and just tell me, like, the city you live in, I went to seminary with a lot of priests from around the country. So I bet I can either find someone in your area or find someone who knows someone in your area who would be well equipped with both kind of the counseling dimension and just being a good priest, a good listener.
Give me that email address again.
Yeah, Joe H.
Pardon me?
Joe H.
Like the number
H. Heschmeyer.
Yep.
H.
Oh, Joe H.
Like H-E-S.
Okay.
Yeah. Joe H. At Catholic.com.
Okay. I'll send you an email.
Wonderful.
Raymond, that's a beautiful testimony. If anyone else is listening and finds himself in the same boat, I would just like to recommend the Coming Home Network. You can find the Coming Home Network just by putting that into your machine, and they will also help you get in touch with the resources that you need when you're ready to enter the Catholic Church. I just wrap it up and go home now. Why even do the rest of the show? That's so beautiful, that call, Raymond. Thank you so much.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Enter promo code EARLY to save $30. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
How do you best lose weight?
It's something we all try to do at some point.
We'll discuss that tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now we return to Catholic Answers Live.
A little bit of groovy music there. Groovy Music Thursday. Groovy for more reasons than one right now. As a matter of fact, special guests joining us in studio at the moment. We'll just hang on. Joe Heschmeyer will just have to wait a moment. Callers, we're going to get to you. And there are lines open. If anyone would like to call, it's open for them. 888-318-7884. But it is one of those, it is a bittersweet day. Today at Catholic Answers. Bittersweet. The bitter is the departure, but the sweet, we'll tell you a bit about. Our assistant producer Maria is here with us. You want to tell people what's happening?
Yeah, so tomorrow's my last day at Catholic Answers, which is the bitter part.
Yeah, we told you eventually you're going to get fired if you kept it up. And so finally the day arrived. That is not true. She's not fired.
I just did too much wrong. Oh my gosh. No, I'm really close to having my baby. I'm about a month and a half away from having my baby, and I'm getting to live the dream and stay home with him when he's born. So, it's
congratulations.
My last day
tomorrow. Yeah, so that's the sweet part is very soon a baby will come, little Cyril. you and David are going to name him Cyril, I heard.
Yeah, everybody gives us some version of that. Our tax guy wanted us to name him Little Ricky because his name is Rick.
No, there's already been a Little Ricky.
I'm like,
there was a famous Little Ricky. You can't have that. There's been no famous Little Cyril. You seem so well. You're in good health, and yes. All expectations are good for the coming child.
Yeah. Everything has been really great and really smooth. It's getting very exciting to think about meeting a new human being very soon. I've been so grateful for my time at Catholic Answers. And I was telling some of the staff yesterday, because they had a little bit of a going away party for me, that listening to the show every day for 3 years and then just all of the work on the podcasts and everything, I have learned so much that I feel definitely like a decently competent apologist at this point.
And finally, you made it.
I think that's going to be really valuable to me as a mom, too, because I'll be the one with our kids teaching them the faith. And so I'm excited that it was just such a wonderful opportunity to have before going into motherhood. So I'm really grateful for that. And this team
Marie,
has been
can
really
I just
fun.
Offer how grateful I am to hear that you're going to be the one teaching your kids.
Oh, because you're friends. Well, you know her husband.
I'm very good friends with her husband.
Yeah. You know what? I had to tell David, I'm going to stop giving him a hard time on the air. I've done it so much. And he's a wonderful man and a very fine teacher of the faith himself. He hosts a podcast called Pints with Jack.
Yes.
And I'm sure going to be a great, great dad. But, you know, as much as you've gotten, we're so grateful for everything that you've given here, Marie. You've been wonderful to work with. But I don't think anyone has ever come to Catholic Answers and left with so much more than they came with. You're leaving with a husband. You're leaving with a child, and you're leaving with an education and apologetics.
Yeah,
so
I came in single, and I'm leaving with all of that.
Yeah, you did good, but I think
I've gotten my second degree in apologetics.
Yeah, and I remember when the summer that you got married, mm-hmm. that the listeners were so supportive. Remember all that month that you were getting married?
Yeah.
The first person who said, "Congratulations, Marie," got a free book or something like that. And people remembered constantly, but then there was
it was very sweet.
And I would tease people because they'd be like the second or third person, and they'd say, "Congratulations, Marie." And I'd be like, "You're not getting a book." And they'd be like, "I don't want a book. I'm just saying congratulations to Marie." So,
these poor people, we put them through.
Yeah, it's been really cool to kind of get to share in that part of your life and to have that part of the program as well.
Yeah, I had a huge outpouring of love from people, over last summer with the wedding, and then when we announced that I was having a baby, and so many people praying, writing emails. Actually, some people have sent things, which is really sweet and totally unnecessary, but it's really nice to know that we really do have a family of like listeners
really
around
is.
This program. And, you know, the Catholic Answers Conference is in September, and I'm missing it this year because I'm having my baby, you know, a few weeks before. But I've gotten to experience some of that Catholic Answers family, like with the staff in the building, but also with listeners who just have shown us so much love and have so much love for Jesus Christ. And I'm not just pitching for the conference. It's a really...
I can't believe you're using your farewell address to pitch for the conference.
It's a really fun place
Chris Check
to
must be so
spend
proud
time
of you.
With that family. So I don't know. You guys are all wonderful, everybody listening. So I'm sad that I'm going to miss you at the conference this year. And I might come back on Skype so that everybody can meet the baby.
Great. Very
after
good.
He's born. So...
Very good.
Yeah. Well,
if you really want to help out, you should give naming rights out to the top donor to Catholic Church.
Oh, that would be good.
Oh, my gosh.
Chris Check is applauding that idea, Joe, right now.
Be careful.
Studio.
I might. My number is pretty high.
You can,
okay?
Yeah.
If you donate.
It's not like a stadium. It's going to be like Alliant. The child's
I'm
going
to say it has to
Alliant
be at least over $200,000.
$200,000 to
least,
name your baby.
At least.
Wow. Good for you, Marie. Good for you. Not underselling yourself. Oh, Chris says higher.
Yeah. Probably, let's just say, let's just say it's got to be at least that, but we can talk if the offers start coming in.
Well, congratulations to you and David. I think it's wonderful that you're in a position where you can go home and do what you wanted to do. It seemed like that was a tough decision for a little bit. And then once you decided, you seemed so at peace with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge blessing. I'll definitely, I know I'll miss my work here and I'll miss everybody, but at the same time, it feels right. And it feels like this is where God is calling us next. So we're really blessed and really excited. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Yesterday, Darren and I had a meeting and we said to each other, should we start talking about what we're going to do once Marie goes? Like, it's so in denial about the fact that you're going.
I know.
It's going to be a mess.
It's come quickly. Yeah. Well, thank you, Si.
Marie Bates, God bless you, sister.
Thank you.
And God bless the little baby and the husband who we, despite the things we say about him on air, who we love and admire very much.
Thanks very much.
God bless you, Joe.
God bless you, too.
Joe, you want to say anything?
Yeah, Marie has been an amazing force behind the scenes, and I'd want to echo the "it's all in fun" with David. I was thinking about the line in Hebrews that God only chastens those who are sons, and I think Catholic Answers takes a similar approach.
Yes,
it's a sign of love.
Yeah,
thanks, Joe.
But he's been in California like 20 years, and he still has a British accent.
He's
like,
been here together, only David. Close get to 12. Together.
Oh, 12 so, years.
Okay. I knew him in Washington D.C. like 10 years ago, and he hasn't lost a day of accent.
Yeah, that's purposeful, and I like it. He's keeping the accent. Thank you both.
All right, get back on the phones, Marie. Somebody's got to run this show. All right, thanks, Marie. Thanks very much, and congratulations again. I know that lots of folks are praying for you and wishing you very, very well. Tomorrow's our last day, though, so we still got one more day of organization here at the program. Let's go to Indiana. Christina, listening on EWTN, you are up next. Christina, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi.
Hi, Christina.
Hello. So it always bothered me, this story of Uzzah, because I always thought he did a very human thing when he was trying to study the Ark. And I could see myself doing that, grabbing something as it's falling. And I thought, I don't want to say God is being unfair, but it kind of seems that way.
Wait,
but he was killed like that.
Yeah, okay, so you're thinking the death penalty for trying to study the Ark was a bit excessive? All right, I think you're not the first person who's had that occur to them. Joe, what's that all about?
Yeah, so there's a lot of important context that we're missing, that there's no reason Uzzah should be in a position where he is touching the Ark in the first place. I used to be a lawyer, and the thing that Uzzah reminds me of is what's called felony murder. Which is, a lot of states have laws that they'll have something like the death penalty if you commit a murder in the course of committing another felony, even if like the killing is like maybe not even intentional. Like if you're robbing a bank and you accidentally shoot someone and kill them, like you're punished more harshly than if you shot and killed someone by accident in some more innocuous context. So that's what comes to mind, because if so, to give listeners a little sense of what she's talking about, if they're not as familiar as 2 Samuel, in 2 Samuel 6, David, who's just established the capital in Jerusalem, decides to move the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. Now, it's very clear in the Torah, in the first five books, that only the Levites are supposed to be moving the Ark. But David decides to cut corners, and he decides to just bring it himself on a cart. And all of this is actually really disrespectful. And Uzzah and another guy, Ahio, are the ones who are driving the cart. And Uzzah is in the back, Ahio's in the front. So instead of having the whole royal procession, you know, of all the priests, he's just got a couple guys with a cart moving the Ark of God where God is actually present. And so they're going through the hill country of Judah. They hit a bump. Uzzah reaches out. He touches the Ark and he's struck dead. And so the place that he struck dead is named Perez Uzzah. And David has this response where he says, how can the Ark of the Lord come to me? And it takes 3 months. And then they're able to get the Ark from the hill country of Judah into Jerusalem. And when they finally do it the right way, they get the Levites, they get a new cart, they, you know, do everything right. David dances before the Ark. So one thing we should take away from that is like the absolute necessity of holiness. Like God really does care about our holiness, about treating things as holy, about not profaning things. And he uses this whole situation with Uzzah to point to that. But there's a deeper meaning to this as well. If you think about all the elements I just described, so they're in the hill country of Judah for 3 months. There's that line, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? There's this dancing before the ark. All of that should sound a lot like Luke chapter 1 with the visitation. In fact, they even begin the same way. So in 2 Samuel 6, it says David arose and went with all the people who were with him. And then in Luke 1, it says, in those days, Mary arose and went with haste into the hill country to a city of Judah. So they both arise and go. They both are in the hill country of Judah. They both are there for 3 months. There's both of them have this dancing before the Lord in the case of David we just saw. And then we have John the Baptist dancing in the womb of his mother, Elizabeth. And then Elizabeth has a really similar question to David's, only the spirit of it is really different, where David has this question, how can the ark of the Lord come to me, where he's still trying to be in control. Elizabeth has this question of humble joy where she says, and why is this granted me that the mother of my Lord should come to me? And so one of the reasons, as Catholics, we believe Mary's the new ark is because there's a pretty clear parallel between these two events, that Luke is describing the visitation in ways that he had to know sound an awful lot like 2 Samuel. Now, I would add one final thing, and I talk about this at greater length than I've got time for here in my book, A Man Named Joseph, that if you want to understand why Joseph, as a just man, considered divorcing Mary when he realized she's the virgin mother of God, read the story of Uzzah. That if you realize your wife might be the Ark of the New Covenant, as Elizabeth did, if Joseph has even a hint that that might be what's going on here, he's going to want to back away slowly, right? Like if you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, or if you've read the Old Testament, like you don't mess around with the Ark. You treat it with a great solemnity. And that's proper to holiness, that we've lost a sense of that idea of the sacred being something that we're not really worthy to be in the presence of. And when we treat it lightly, as Uzzah did, that's not pleasing to God.
Okay, so that is a lot. Christina, what do you think?
I hear you and I appreciate your answer. I guess I just feel sorry for Uzzah because yeah. I have to wonder, was he following King David's orders? Is he just a guy going, yeah, sure, I'll help with the ark, and then he gets killed? And even the Bible says that David was angry with the mm-hmm. Lord for doing that.
Yeah, it does say that. I mean, David's the one who really is the problem here. If we're being just very blunt about this, David knows better and is cutting corners where he shouldn't be cutting corners. I think you're right that Uzzah and Ahio are there following the king's orders. Now, one thing to notice as you're reading the Old Testament is that time and time again, people follow the king rather than following God, and it doesn't end well. As Christians, we should really take that message to heart, that sometimes what secular society says to do, what our bosses tell us to do, what leaders tell us to do, may not be consistent with what God is calling for, and we may need to actually be courageous. Just following orders is just not a good enough kind of excuse to violate what God has said in terms of what to do and not do.
We got to leave it there, Christina, because we're a little bit late for the break. I hope that was helpful to you. You're welcome to call back another time if it's not, if you need a follow-up. Hey, we talked a little bit about the conference, September 23rd through 26th here, but the early bird pricing ends Friday, I think. So you have to put in the promo code early and you get $30 off if you sign up before close of business, or not to close of business, before midnight Hawaii time tomorrow. Full conference ticket includes the banquet dinner with the keynote address from Bishop Joseph Strickland, but you can also get the partial ticket. That's just the talks ticket. Both of them very inexpensive and $30 off if you get your ticket before Friday. Just visit CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
I'm Kimberly Hahn, and my new show, Beloved and Blessed, is now on EWTN Radio. Every week, I share scripture and my personal experience to speak to the desires and strengths of all women so that each of us can better live out our vocations as daughters of God. Tune in to find inspiration, hope, and strength in each episode.
Don't miss Beloved and Blessed with Kimberly Hahn, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, only on EWTN Radio.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? set up a sign on the sidewalk, and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It seems so real now. I feel sad that Marie's leaving all of a sudden. It just seems real. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a bunch of books, including Pope Peter. And you are welcome to call with your questions, whether you're Catholic or not, 888-318-7884. Up next is Julianne from College Station, Texas. Julianne, you there with us?
Yes.
Hi, Julianne. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
So at the end of the world, will babies who have died babies have baby bodies in heaven?
That's a really good question.
That's an awesome question.
That is Well, let's make it even more complicated. Think about all the other people who are maybe extremely elderly when they die, or, you know, have had some like terrible mutilation happen to them during their lifetime. There is this question that we're never given an explicit answer to in scripture about what the resurrection body will look like. St. Thomas Aquinas, in the supplement to the third part of the Summa, which is the very end of his work, the Summa Theologiae, this part was actually compiled after his death based on his own writings. He talks about the resurrection body. And if memory serves, he suggests like 33 is the ideal age because it's the age at which Christ died. And so he seems to think there will be some sort of like full maturation. I don't know. I don't want to go further than that in terms of saying he seems to suppose that there will be some at least restoration to those who, you know, because obviously there will be some kind of bodily restoration. You know, if someone is incinerated, they're not going to rise again as ashes, or if someone's like eaten by a shark or something like that. You know, I don't know why that's the example.
But it's so shark there's going to be some.
Yeah, like, good point.
Think you got shark on the brain.
So there's clearly a sense of bodily restoration. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff written about how that kind of works with matter, but that's a subject for another day. Actually, there's a great Catholic Answers Focus episode on that with Trent Horn, I believe, where he looks at that.
Is there? Well, I'll find the title of it. We'll put it in the show notes. Julianne, okay. Is this are you getting the answer that you're looking for?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Julianne, how old are you, if I may ask?
10.
Well, thank you so much for your call. I really, really appreciate the call. I didn't realize that it was such a mature question. I didn't realize how young you are, but boy, you're sharp. And call again sometime, all right?
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Joe, maybe don't...
That's fantastic.
Maybe not a full exposition of the Summa Theologica when 10-year-olds call. I'm just throwing that
out
there.
You know what? Like, I think 10-year-olds who ask that question deserve full answers. if she's going to ask a good question, right, she's going to get a good answer.
I'm just saying, take it easy on the 10-year-old. But she's smart. She got what she was looking for.
I didn't say tertia pars. I said third part because I knew she was 10. Oh, otherwise,
thanks. You wouldn't say tertia pars to me because you know I wouldn't know what you're
saying.
Yeah, all right. Casey in Texas listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. You are next. Go ahead, Casey.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. So my question is, why, when a pope is elected, does he take on a new name, and how far back does that tradition go start from?
Yeah, so that tradition dates back to 533, and the reason for it was originally pretty pragmatic. There was a fellow by the name of Mercurius who was named after Mercury, the Roman god. Now, these days, Mercury is just all fun and good. It's an element and your thermometer, and it's a planet. But, you know, back when paganism was still a real thing, he felt, I think rightly, that having a pope named after a pagan god didn't quite feel right. So when he became the Bishop of Rome, when he became the Pope, he decided to take the name John II in honor of Pope John I, that he wanted to kind of, honor him, since he realized it wasn't fitting for him to have his birth name since it had pagan origins. And then this just kind of caught on, that after him, popes began to take a name to honor a saint or honor a prior pope. And it gives a little bit of a hint sometimes about their pontificate, about how they envision what they're going to do. So, for instance, Benedict XVI wanted to honor Benedict XV. Pope John Paul II wanted to honor John Paul I. John Paul I wanted to honor John the 23rd and Paul VI. And, you know, so you have this idea that, you know, Pope Francis takes this, the first, you know, he's not named after a prior pope, but instead he's looking at St. Francis of Assisi as kind of a model. So looking at a pope or a saint as sort of a model for this new state of life that these popes find themselves in. Now, it's not required. And as recently as the 16th century, we find popes who went by their baptismal name, who took the name that they were baptized with, the name that they grew up with. But it has become sort of a small T tradition or a custom that I think is actually, you know, really beautiful.
What do you think, Casey?
That is a great answer. Is that the same reason why religious brothers and sisters would take on a new name as well?
Yeah, so I think it's coming from a sort of similar place. You're recognizing this kind of radical change in your state in life. Religious brothers and sisters also traditionally have dropped their last name to show that they're no longer claiming like the inheritance rights and everything else. They're sort of disinheriting themselves. So if you come from like a really noble family, you're losing that last name when you become a brother or a sister because you're living this life of radical poverty instead.
Thanks, Casey. I'm going to try to get more folks on before we have to go. Second hour, don't worry, Jimmy Akin will be here. We'll continue with Open Forum. This hour, Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, and we go to Columbia, Maryland now. Catherine in Columbia, Maryland, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Catherine, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out, I'm grappling with a situation at work. Your couple callers ago where you ended it about being courageous and standing up for orders given by a boss or certain things. So I'm a marketing person, and with the new inclusion diversity situations going on in our country, I've been asked to incorporate same-sex marriage images within our marketing.
Ah.
And I want to be, I'm grappling with, if I do it, am I showing love or am I showing dishonesty and not leading the true way?
Yeah, Catherine, I'm sympathetic to you because it seems like every TV commercial now, they're you know, if they depict three or four families, you have to have a couple that are same sex in there as well. It just seems to be that this is the new marketing minimum. So you're doing the marketing for your company and they're asking you to do the same thing in your ads.
Correct. I've already refused once, and the company doesn't have like a policy yet, so that talk is coming.
Yeah.
When my boss gets back, but I've kind of had a conversation with the CEO, and you know he wants to make it work, and he doesn't want to drive me out, and he doesn't want to flip the tables, or well, now I'm excluded.
That's so, you're blessed to have such a boss. But Joe, what do you say?
Yeah. So the general thing that we're looking at there with cooperation. So I'll give you the bottom line up front. I think it would be immoral to do any kind of promotion of same-sex marriage, including in like promotional materials. The general thing we're looking at is with what's called cooperation with evil. When you have formal cooperation where you're actively doing something to promote evil, I think this is what this is, then that's always wrong. There's sometimes more distant, what's called material cooperation with evil. So for instance, if you own a telecommunications company and you know people are broadcasting immoral messages, you don't have a direct duty to like personally intervene and censor that. That's more remote. But in the case where you're directly involved with it, those are pretty clear cases that you can never do that. You can never promote something evil. And so just to be clear, we're not just talking about like depicting objective reality. You know, there are same-sex couples and all that. Rather, this is part of a pretty concerted effort to normalize and to promote this. Like, this is being shown at a really disproportionate rate and pretty consciously. I went to law school and one of my professors had sued over a lack of minority representation in real estate ads, that companies know what they promote is having an effect on how people think about what they view as normal. So I think this is a pretty clear case of promoting evil, unfortunately.
Call back again if you, as things develop. It'd be interesting to follow your story, Catherine, and maybe, often there are fine distinctions that need to be made. And as those become apparent, if you want to call and we'll talk about it, that'd be great. Joe Heschmeyer has been our guest. You can find all of Joe's books at shop.catholic.com. Joe, thanks. Another very fine hour.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you got that internet working too.
Me too.
Yep. And work on those answers for 10-year-olds. Coming up next, Jimmy Akin. We'll continue with open forum. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet and you've got a question, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome here. 888-318-7884.